Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkin.
And this is Core Intuition, on a very slow track. This episode is sponsored by the PDF Pen family from Smile. All right, Daniel, well, throughout the year, there's been a theme that we keep coming back to from time to time, and that's actually shipping the software that we're working on. And,
no.
that can't be avoided. At some point, we have to finish what we're doing. And, you know, I know it's been a long struggle. I don't know if struggle is the right word. It's a long process, you know, trying to wrap up Mars Edit. And you did the preview, and we talked a lot about that. But, like, what's the update? Like, where are you now that you've, you know, you've had a beta process, you've got feedback, kind of had a tentative part of the year that you wanted to ship in? Like, where are you?
Boy, I wish I knew. I think I am, whatever's happening to me with Mars Edit 4, it's not completely bad, but it's not completely good because it's, we're recording this now, October 4th, way back in June, I think, I made the decision to release a public beta, and the idea was release a public beta, breathe a sigh of relief, and then spend the summer fixing up the last few little things and crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and then stroll into September with this, like, not only complete, but now, like, beta, public beta strong product. And it's just gotten a little bit, whatever happened over the summer, I didn't really expand the scope too much, but I got really slow at working on some of those last things. And, you know, like a few weeks ago on the show, I said, oh, I'm getting close, Manton, because I'm working on serial codes and licensing. And unfortunately, I haven't even finished that. There's some complications involved. I've had some, like, family commitments that have taken me off of my normal work schedule. But the fact of the matter is I have had enough work days that, in my opinion, if I were my own manager, I would be tapping my foot with my arms crossed at the door saying, what the heck's going on here? We need to talk.
So with the serial number scheme, is that a case where you just kind of need to push through and do it, or do you need to simplify it and rethink it so you can wrap it up? Because technically it's optional. I mean, you wanted to do it, yeah. But it's not like you absolutely need that, right? You could continue to ship with the previous slightly less robust serial number scheme.
It's true. And I think at this point, I do just need to kind of follow through and finish it. I would say it is the roadmap for finishing that is clear, more or less. So I think it would be a waste at this point to just ditch it and stick with my current scheme. Like, I think I could probably wrap that up in a day if I put my mind to it.
Okay.
The problem with so many things that I work on is I have to figure out when. I love this aspect of working for myself that I can just, like, follow an impulse and then experiment with things and play around with something new. I think probably over the years I've gotten much better at following the impulses and lost some of the discipline of following through on my own plans. This is a perfect example because I am ashamed to admit that my serial number registration scheme work actually led me down a path to where I found myself looking at Swift on the server frameworks. because I implemented my registration scheme on the Mac. I'm doing it very diligently with unit tests all along the way. Because I think, you know, especially with this kind of stuff, you don't want to screw it up and give somebody a code that doesn't work, or give, you know, make your code verify with any old code. But I ended up doing this, I thought, pretty clever thing where I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to make I'm going to develop the license encoder and the license decoder in tandem. It makes sense because you need to be able to have one to test the other. Do all the writing, the code on my Mac, test it all along the way with Xcode. And then I was thinking in the back of my mind, well, it's going to be kind of weird to have this code on my Mac that can create serial codes, because that's never going to happen. That's going to all have to run on my server when a person buys the product. And so I was thinking all along, well, I'll just have this, you know, license generator code as kind of like a standard point of reference. And then I'll write a PHP script that does the same thing, or a Python script.
Yeah.
And then something caught my eye. I saw some, like, somebody linked to a video or something for Vapor, one of those Swift and the server frameworks.
Yeah.
And it just caught my imagination, where I was like, hey, it would be kind of nice if I could run that same Swift code on the server.
That's the dream.
And so then what happened? So that was an interesting, like, thought. And then I went down this path of, like, watching a video about Vapor and being like, whoa. As you know, Manton, as I think you know, and as I think our listeners know, I'm sort of like catching the Swift interest. You know, like, I'm kind of like, I'm tantalized by Swift now in a way that I definitely wasn't at the beginning. And I'm just like increasingly interested in it. And so I started looking at this video, and I was like, what started as like, huh, maybe I could use that to host my serial number generator, became like, oh man, I gotta ditch WordPress and like write my whole site in Swift, and also need to like make a clean room implementation of basically WordPress with Swift. And don't worry, now I didn't start working on any of this stuff, but this is the way my mind works. And I got distracted a little bit, just kind of like not working on any of those things, but just kind of like following up on what the state of Swift on the server is. And that's just one example of the problem of my procrastination with Mars Edit 4. So I need to hunker down one of these days and probably give myself a deadline. And when I start to think of giving myself a deadline, I get really anxious, because I think, first of all, deadlines are scary because you might miss them. But second of all, deadlines are scary because that is the day that your work will have to be evaluated, you know? So deadlines are scary if you make them or if you miss them, because if you miss them, you're quote unquote in trouble. If you make them, that's the day it all comes down. That's when people judge your work. That's when people decide whether they're going to pay you. That's when people will, if you're lucky, talk about your work in public. And some of that's going to be positive and some of that's going to be negative. I've sort of been taking stock a little bit about like what really are all the reasons that I haven't shipped yet, and I think it would be incorrect to say that it's any one simple thing, but this kind of combination of procrastination, technical diversions, some legitimate like just surprises, and then there's this other like little issue, which is I've decided to do some light icon UI work. Mm-hmm. So that's like an outsourced thing.
Well, that can work in parallel.
Yeah.
So that's maybe one idea up. And I like that idea, actually. I think that's a really good idea for a major version, to give it a little something new that that people will say, oh, this is new. This looks a little different.
Yeah, right.
On the Swift server, like, trap that you almost fell into, and you kind of did a little bit. I mean, I don't know how many hours you spent kind of going down that rabbit hole, but don't do that. Yeah, don't do that. It's way too early, especially in a product that needs to get out the door. You don't want to adopt like a cutting edge technology that is completely unproven. And like, I experimented a little with Swift on the server year and a half ago, just tinkering, and it's way better now. But even now, that's huge mistake. And I know some people have shipped apps, like the app Beacon that was released around WWDC, is all the server's all in Swift. The app, you know, the iOS app and the server's all in Swift. It can work, but I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. And I definitely wouldn't recommend that to you. It's just like, that seems like a major diversion. There's so many, it's not a robust, proven, stable framework platform. It's like, you will be the guinea pig for everything. And that's not to say it won't work perfectly. And maybe your use case is really simple and you won't run into any problems. But if time is an issue, you don't want to be the one running into the bleeding edge edge cases.
Yeah. Well, here's the reason it was tantalizing at first is because it occurred to me that at the heart of it, Swift on the server just means being able to compile a Swift binary and have it run.
I don't think that's true, though. That's a simplification.
Well, it's a simplification that works for my the motivation that brought me there, because, you know, currently my setup is basically my license codes are generated by outsourcing to a PHP or a Python script, right? So there's nothing to prevent that outsourcing on the server backend from being calling a binary that happened to be compiled with Swift. And, you know, so in other words, I don't need to use something like Vapor or some kind of like high level, you know, standardizing all like web connections. You know, I don't need to use something that actually does the web server part of Swift on the server. So there's a little bit of an attraction to just say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I could compile this logic from this class on my Mac into a standalone tool that, you know, happens to also be compilable on Linux? And that would mean basically the investment would be, you know, getting Swift running on my Linux box, but that actually is fairly well supported because it's like a, you know, it's a supported feature of Swift maintained by Apple. Now, all the supporting libraries is where it gets tricky. And In this particular case, I realized pretty quickly, oh, I'm using a proprietary Apple framework. You know, the, what's it called? Common Crypto. And I don't think that is on Linux. So it would just be like kind of dumb if I were to, it would mean like factoring out the crypto part of this code. And at that point, it's like, well, you know, this isn't that complicated anyway. I probably should just write a Python script or a PHP script that meets the letter of what it's supposed to do. But just to say, like, it wouldn't be unreasonable, I think, for a lot of use cases where the Swift code is really doing kind of like pure model level functionality. I don't think it would be that unreasonable to install Swift on a Linux box, compile a binary, and have that binary's functionality available to, say, a Python or a PHP script that wants to just outsource to it. It wouldn't be a high-performance situation, but it...
Oh, okay. So that was going to be my next question, is how would you call the Swift code? And so, because, I mean, you could have a Swift server that listened, you know, and responded in HTTP stuff. You could have, like, a CGI that, like, Apache or Nginx, you know, forwarded requests to. Or you could have, like you said, like an actual command line tool that was invoked with a PHP script. And it sounds like that third way is what you were thinking.
That's right, because that matches what I'm doing already. So no, that's another example of why it doesn't need all the fancy overhead of a full supported server framework. It's not something that, you know, it's generating a license code is not something that happens hundreds of times for a user. It happens, if I'm lucky, once, and then, you know, they get on with their life. So it really doesn't matter if it's a low performance calling out to a whole separate process and all that jazz.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too risky if you do it that way. The trap is when you, like, because when I think of Swift on the server, I think of, like, for my needs, like, like a full application, web application, and then you're talking about managing multiple processes and the web server, and there's a lot of complexity. You know, do you need to hit a database? Do you use a cache? I mean, there's a lot of things going on. If you just call, like, a command line tool and it does one job and has no other dependencies, that definitely makes it quite a bit simpler.
Yep.
That's not, when people talk about Swift on a server, that's not what they say.
No,
that's,
I know. I realized that. I was just, that's why I was clarifying that I don't really need all that overhead. But it was just reading up about Swift on the server that got me interested in the whole idea. And then on further reflection, I realized, oh, I don't even need all that stuff to do the one specific thing that had caught my attention.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So you decided to scrap that, but you'll still need to port your code to Python or PHP.
Yep.
Or something. Yeah.
I think that's the gist of it. This kind of security license code stuff, in my experience, is like 99% figuring out how you want to structure the code, the license. and figuring out what the security ramifications of certain choices are. And then it's like 1% actually writing the code. So mm-hmm. I don't think when I decide to power through on this, I don't think it's going to take me long to finish up the Mac code and then also just power out some PHP or Python code that does the same type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what do you have? You have the crypto stuff to wrap up. You've got some kind of parallel work on design and then those kind of changes. What else do you have? Do you have anything else big, or is there just bug fixes, tweaks, updating the website?
Pretty much
kind of usual stuff.
Pretty much just the small tweaks and stuff. I mean, I think I could release it. I mean, to be honest, I could release it right now and it wouldn't matter that much. I mean, I could call this Mars Edit 4 and release it. I have set, you know, some goals to add a few more things. There's one thing I'm on the fence about, but I think I will end up going ahead and doing. It's syncing the media assets of a site down to the Mac, because currently Mars Edit doesn't do that, and it's very frustrating for people who expect, say, a photo that they uploaded to their WordPress blog a week before they bought Mars Edit. They go looking in Mars Edit's media and it's not there. And it's because historically WordPress didn't offer API support for browsing that catalog. And I just never got around to adding it once they did. And so it's kind of like, it should be, I envision it being pretty easy to implement because it should be kind of like a parallel structure to what Mars Edit already does to download your posts. And I'll just have a kind of variation on that to download all your media. But of course, you know, I don't know what the complications are going to be when I start to do that. So,
right. Does that use like is it part of the XML RPC?
Yes.
API, or is it okay? Yeah. So that's kind of funny. I mean, maybe there are no complications, but like one thing that jumps out to me is, you know, all media probably needs to be base64 encoded.
I think the way that this works, luckily, that is a huge problem with media uploads to WordPress. But I think the way that the media library access API works is that it just exposes in the XML, just references the media.
That's better. Then you can simply download them. And so it exposes probably the like multiple sizes and all that kind of thing.
Yep. So saying it out loud, I'm not sure if WordPress accommodates the idea of private media. You know, typically you need a username and password to download posts through the API. But if there are just like bare URLs to media that you can download, I don't know if that's an issue or not. That's an example of something I'd have to, you know, cross that bridge when I get there. But this whole feature, I think I want to get it in there because it's one of those things that I think a lot of users who are new to the app would be turned off by finding that it doesn't support that. And they'd either be turned off or confused or maybe even, you know, upset by it. But this is always a problem with a new release. You kind of want to capture, you get this opportunity to make a new first impression on a lot of people.
Right.
And you don't want to never ship and like spend the rest of your life trying to make sure you make a good first impression. But this might be one of those like, it's worth the investment to actually just go ahead and do it. But if it starts to give me grief, I'll just drop it and make it like a 4.1 feature.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, it sounds like you're on track. Good luck finishing everything up and hope it goes smoothly and doesn't drag on until I know. You know, both of us were trying to wrap things up kind of like before the summer and then after the summer and then the fall and like,
yeah,
hopefully it doesn't drag on until you get into the holidays. And then it's really easy to
make
the excuse of like, oh, well, I can't ship, you know, on Thanksgiving. I can't ship like a week before Christmas. So like now it's 2018.
Yeah, I really need to pull it together. Yep. I'm on a very slow track. I'm on track, but I'm on a very slow track.
Cool.
It's going to get there eventually.
All right, this week we are sponsored again by the PDF Pen family from Smile. Edit PDFs like the professional you are with the PDF Pen family. PDF Pen for macOS is the ultimate PDF editing tool. It's your Swiss Army knife of PDF. PDF Pen Scan Plus adds scanning and OCR to your mobile toolkit. Scan and OCR when away from your desk and scanner. Scan receipts with ease. The new PDF Pen 3 for iPad and iPhone combines our PDF tools with the new iOS 11 files infrastructure, making it incredibly easy to access files from a variety of sources, including Dropbox, Google Drive, and anything you can reach via Transmit. See smilesoftware.com/podcast for details on the PDF Pen family.
Manton, you know we've talked about PDF Pen a lot on this show, and it's so easy to talk about how great it is because it is consistently maintained, updated, features are added. The fact that it's on all these different platforms and you can use it to interoperate with different files here, there, everywhere. I'm also excited. It's just the new PDF Pen 9.2 for Mac. Funny little things I get excited about. Updating the OCR engine. I actually use PDF Pen for OCR, for converting to searchable, making searchable all my PDF scans. I'm getting excited about updating to that and making my PDF scans more accurate. The great thing overall about PDF Pen, I always think about it like this. You have Preview on the Mac, right? And you can work with PDFs, and you inevitably get to a point where there's something you want to do that you can't do. And that's where PDF Pen comes in. Because the difference is PDF Pen is being developed constantly, adding features, fixing bugs, making it better for users. And there's a strong incentive to do that with PDF Pen because they are making their living out of this. So if you haven't checked out PDF Pen, you really owe it to yourself. Go to smilesoftware.com/podcast. And when you buy something from Smile, please remember to tell them that you heard about it from Core Intuition. Thanks so much to PDF Pen and Smile for sponsoring the show.
So Daniel, as you were talking about this feature you're evaluating from our set of pulling photos and media down from WordPress, it kind of matches some of the work that I've been doing on micro.blog. Specifically, I made this kind of statement. I talked about this on my timetable microcast a couple weeks ago about how to really eat my own dog food, I need to move my site from WordPress to micro.blog, like hosting. You know, I use micro.blog, of course, for cross-posting. I use the iOS app. I will be using the Mac app when I finish working on it. But I don't actually host my blog posts on micro.blog. They're on WordPress. And so I have been working on a WordPress import feature, and I know some other people that use micro.blog would love that too. And one of the problems with WordPress import is, I mean, it's one thing to just grab all the posts, not a huge deal. You can export your posts in a couple formats, but the like kind of the default WordPress format is called WXR, WordPress Extended RSS. It's RSS, but with a bunch of namespaces and extra tags for WordPress. And that's fine, but what about all your images? And of course, it has references to them. But what about all the images that I uploaded to an images folder before I was using WordPress and just reference with HTML tags? And so it's a different feature than what you're working on, but it's similar in that, like, as soon as you jump from just grabbing some text to grabbing all the images, you know, all the photos that people have been posting to their blog for years, it becomes a much bigger feature.
Yeah, that is interesting. As you describe it, I know you sort of see like having to scrape every post and look for image URLs as like a drag, because like it would be nicer if you could just, you know, get the list. But it actually seems kind of better, like for the semantics of what you're trying to do. You theoretically want to have a private copy of every image in a blog. And so, for example, if somebody had like made a rookie mistake of hot linking to an image file on another site, you know, you get this problem so common where it used to be more common where people would do that. And then eventually it turns into like a image not found, or if they're really unlucky, somebody sabotages them and inserts like a profane image. So that's one example where actually what you want, if you're going to make like a pristine copy, a new starting over of a blog, you don't want the whole list of what's in the blog. You actually want what it was, what is demonstrably shown in image tags on the blog's posts. Mm-hmm. So that's one example. The other example is what I've experienced using WordPress over the years is I'll often like upload a post with an image. And then I'll be like, oh, actually, that image, that's not quite right. And so I'll go in and I'll edit it and upload a different image. Now I've got this stale image on WordPress that is just sitting there taking up space, never going to be shown on any blog post. And so there's another example where if you just imported by what's being shown, you would get a cleaner start. So ironically, you sort of like might be better off. You know, there's other phenomena like... you know, this is more likely to be true on service like Tumblr, where they don't make it easy to insert arbitrary images in a post through their API. You have to make a quote unquote photo type post. So some people have resorted to weird things like, oh, I'll just write my blog on Tumblr, but all my images will be on Flickr. And like, I don't know, these are just examples where. Yeah. There's sort of an argument to be made for grabbing everything, but there's also sort of an argument to be made for just grabbing what you actually see.
Right. And so, and I had thought that what I would do is I would look at all the image URLs that WordPress natively knows about, right, in the media tab section of WordPress. And for, I think for a lot of WordPress users, everything is there. And actually, over the weekend, I was at the WordCamp conference in San Antonio. I went down there to try to like get a feel for the WordPress community and see what people were up to. In one of the talks, someone specifically said, make sure everything is in your WP content folder, which is where your plugins and your media and everything goes. Never put anything anywhere else, because that's the folder that will be backed up with WordPress tools. That's the folder that if you're moving to a new server that you copy. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I don't know how many people stick to that.
Yeah.
But if they stick to that, you can ask WordPress for all the images and it's all right there. But yeah, like my blog predates WordPress by a decade. And so I have got images all over the place. I don't know. So I mean, when I was thinking about like parsing HTML, looking for the image tags and then downloading those images, I was thinking that I would make sure the domain name matched and not grab an image if it's like referenced from Flickr.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I can kind of see... You can kind of see both sides to it.
Well, like you don't want to be, it's like the classic example of downloading a Twitter archive. Boy, if you downloaded a Twitter archive in 1999, you sure wish you would have copied every image, right? Instead of just referencing TwitPic or something that's not in business anymore.
Exactly. And there's so many of those old tweets that used services that no longer work. Yeah, honestly, I don't know what the best solution is here. I certainly would hate for someone to use this feature. They migrate their blog, everything looks great, and then they shut down their WordPress server, and then all of a sudden they realize they've missed something.
Yep.
And it's hard to just, I mean, if you just glance at a blog and everything looks right, it's hard to know, did I miss anything? Is it actually a complete copy of everything?
So what you could do, Manton, if you really are on the fence, like my thinking is pretty strongly that you should just make a copy of everything. There might be like, I don't know, there might be like copyright issues. I'm not sure. So it might be something you want to be a little thoughtful about. But in the event that you decide to just link, to leave external links intact, what you could do as a nice user-friendly function is still download that asset. Put it in a little folder called like external assets. Then the user has a copy of everything. Maybe even key it by like the URL, right? Something like that. If you're on the fence about it, you have the opportunity as the developer of this migrator to keep a permanent archive of the stuff that's referenced, even if you decide to continue referencing it.
Interesting. So then I would have to build some kind of UI where they could browse those unneeded. What do you mean?
I mean, not necessarily. This is kind of like a fail-safe in my mind.
Okay.
Or it's like maybe you build the UI for browsing it later when people start saying, hey, actually,
yeah,
you know. But like, yeah, as a first step, this is one of those things where you could like do something thoughtful that's just sort of mm-hmm. like there as a backup.
Yeah, it's proactive. And I mean, I certainly, because I want the user to feel like the software has their back and just takes care of everything. I definitely don't want them to be frustrated. On the other hand, it's no if I don't grab those external image links, they're no worse off. They didn't have those to begin with on their WordPress site.
Right.
So it's not like there's data loss because of my migration tool, but I like your idea of being proactive just in case. I think there has to be some kind of line. Like maybe it even knows about certain, I don't want to hard code weird edge cases and stuff into it, but for example, Flickr, I think would be a great example of where, yeah, I kind of would want those pulled in. But like if you embed a YouTube video, no, I'm not going to download that for you. Right. So I don't know. Kind of think through what the best default is.
And just to complete the, I had another thought come into mind, which interestingly enough favors querying the database through the API again, which is, at least with WordPress, you can end up with a situation where you're referencing the media asset at a scaled size, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you, the argument that you should just get what is shown on the blog, there's a little, that falls down a little bit when what's shown on the blog is a scaled down version of a larger image that maybe the user wants to keep the larger image, right?
Right, because when you upload a photo to WordPress, it makes a few sizes for you.
Yeah.
And I believe in the WXR format that it references all those sizes when you do the export. Again, it doesn't include the image data, but it does include a reference to all the sizes. So, mm-hmm. and that adds a lot of complexity for me because, I mean, maybe I don't want all those sizes. But yeah, from the user perspective, maybe all those sizes are important and they should be preserved.
So, or I think probably you can distinguish which one is the original size.
Yes.
And then I would say, from a user point of view, I would be satisfied if you downloaded the original size, and then as a consequence of whatever, I think maybe your best solution here, even though it's more complicated, is going to end up being querying the media library and doing a kind of fail-safe scan. Mm-hmm. And then you could get the best of both worlds, although it would be a bit more work for you, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I'm using my own blog as kind of the test for this. And for my own blog, because I have images that predate WordPress, that's the only way it will work.
Yeah.
I have to do both. And or I at some point I have to parse all the HTML posts and grab those. And there'll be richer metadata and whatnot if I get the kind of the truth from WordPress as well. So yeah, if the benchmark of like, can I ship this feature is, does it work for my blog? I have to be pretty exhaustive, and it has to work. It has to have a lot of logic in it, I think, that most people may not even need. Now, my blog has other things going on too, because I mean, I put all sorts of files and things that are not referenced and linked in WordPress at all. So that's a whole separate issue. But just for photos specifically, I think doing both of those things would kind of cover all my bases.
Yeah, I think so. I think that once you get in there and start doing this, I don't think it's going to be that knowing that you have to do both. I think it's just going to come down to having a good organization in mind for how you're going to store everything. And because, mm-hmm. you know, once you know that you're doing both, probably do the database dump first, and then all the URLs for those originals are going to match up with, you know, the references that you find. So your logic might end up being like, oh, okay, I just found this reference. Is it in my, you know, database dump version? No. Okay. I got to go fetch that, whatever.
Yeah. And URLs is a whole separate thing too, because URLs are not the same. Like, I mean, WordPress sites can have all sorts of URLs. It's completely customizable. And micro.blog sites, the URLs are all consistent across all the themes and, you know, all
right.
the users. And so I plan to have a kind of mapping table of sorts so I can preserve redirects from your previous site so that all the URLs still work. I don't plan to do that for images. And I think that's probably correct. I mean, it would be nice if all those crazy, you know, thumbnail images and stuff URLs worked, but I think that's going a little, that adds a little too much complexity. And the way I deal with photos, I have like an image server, kind of like a content store of sorts on the server, where I put photos when they're uploaded and then those are published out to your own website. And I can only do so much. I mean, it adds a lot of complexity to the back end if I support everything. So I'm hoping to cover like all the defaults so that things just work and old URLs are supported, but I can't spend months on this feature. I mean, it can't get too out of control.
Au contraire, let me tell you how you can spend months on the feature. Well, so you mentioned, Menton, that you sort of off the cuff said something like, and that's how it will work in the Mac app too, when it's done. So now you're getting into my territory, man. Are you going to ship a full-featured Mac blogging app before I release Mars Edit 4?
I don't know. What's your schedule? I think this probably deserves a longer discussion, but the quick answer is I'm finally working on the Mac app again. I had really struggled with, like, I know I want a Mac app eventually, but like I use Mars Edit, like all my microblog posts, I post in Mars Edit, they go to my blog, micro.blog immediately notices them and sends them to Twitter as tweets and, you know, Facebook if you want that. And like, I have a nice workflow. I type in Mars Edit, it works fine. But eventually I knew I wanted a micro.blog native app so that you can have the timeline, you can reply to people, and you can also post. But I'm just one person. Like, I can't build every platform under the sun. People ask for Android. They ask for everything. I've got the web app. I've got the iOS app. And so I try to, like, is there a shortcut? Is there, like, how can I get this Mac app out? And I even went down the path of thinking about whether I could use the UXKit framework that Apple has in, like, Photos app. And that would be a complete hack. And I eventually, very quickly, decided that would be not a good idea. But then, I mean, I evaluated like Electron, but that's got all sorts of baggage and bloat that I don't want to deal with. Anyway, I finally am on track to do a native Mac app. It has a web view, even just like the iOS app has. There's a lot of web view components, but it is a native app and it's really been fun to work on and kind of get used to Mac development again. Anyway, to answer your question, it probably will not be full featured when it ships. Because when you're on your Mac, you have a lot of options like Mars Edit, you have the WordPress web admin, you've got, you know, other things. It will probably be like the timeline and posting to micro.blog and replying. It'll have the basics. So it's like a more native experience for people that don't want to remember to open Safari. But I don't think it will go head to head with Mars Edit right away. Because like the iOS app has full support for posting to WordPress. For the MicroPub API, I can post to a lot of different servers because it felt like having everything right there in one app just made a lot of sense. I think eventually I'll get there on the Mac, but I don't think I'm going to get there for the first version. I think the first version just needs to be really focused on micro.blog, and then we'll see where things go from there.
I would just like to point out how funny it is that you and I met each other over 10 years ago. Or about 10 years ago, at least. Mm-hmm. And we somehow found this common interest in Mac development that we would both start a podcast together. And then neither one of us realizing that 10 years down the road, we would both be working on Mac blog editing apps.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. What are the odds of two people in the world working on a Mac apps, period, but then both working on Mac blogging apps. It's just kind of a funny,
right?
Maybe it's evidence of our you know, destiny as podcast cohorts.
Yeah, and you know, we've always loved to blog. You know, I've been a Mars Edit user from, like, even before you had it, you know, when Brent was maintaining it and when it was part of NetNewsWire. But it's taken me a long time to kind of like loop back around to actually building blogging kind of tools again. It's been a kind of a long journey. It will be interesting. Like, let's say I ship the micro.blog Mac app and has full support for like posting to WordPress and all this kind of stuff. Like, it won't be as full featured as Mars Edit, not even close. It's very focused.
Yeah.
But it will be interesting if we compete on at some level, and whether that will cause any problems, honestly. I mean, you know, I mean, we're friends, and it'd just be interesting to see what happens. And I'd like to hear what you think about that. I think that there are millions of bloggers out there, and that that's all we can do just to get awareness of our, it's not like we're competing for a small number of users.
Right. Yep.
It's kind of interesting.
I mean, it is interesting. I have long had an attitude that I've talked with you about before. I had a conference talk about it at NS Conference. Basically, I have just committed to not being threatened by quote-unquote competitors because... Mm-hmm.
Are you saying quote-unquote about my acts?
Yeah, I mean the quote-unquote as a support of your attitude that you just expressed. Yeah. That there's so many customers out there. The conclusion I've come to over the years, of course, I enjoy when I run a competitor's app and I spot something where I can tell that they haven't, you know, whatever, dealt with the complexity of something the way I have. And, you know, and I also enjoy, for that matter, running something and discovering that they've handled something better than I handle it. But it's like you say, there's just so many different people in the world who are blogging and have a Mac. And the fact is, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's over 99% of them don't use a Mac app. Don't use, even if they have a Mac, they don't use a Mac app to write to their blog.
Yep.
So like I have for a long time been excited when I see somebody coming out with a new Mac app for blogging, because it's one of these things where anybody who does anything to increase the visibility of the idea of writing for a blog from a Mac app is doing me a favor. At least that's what I choose to believe.
Yeah.
And I think you'll be doing the same. And, you know, you hosting a microblog service, it's obviously, I appreciate that you link to Mars Edit right now from the list of, you know, tools you can use.
And I won't be taking the links away.
You certainly will, you cutthroat.
No, I mean, I was going to say it's a tricky balance, but I don't actually think it's that tricky. From day one, I have wanted to support and encourage third-party developers, whether they write to the micro.blog API or whether they're existing apps like Mars Edit, and also acknowledge that I do need default native apps to make things more approachable and easy for people to get started. I think that was a mistake that other social networks and blogging platforms have made, and I don't want to make that mistake. But I think I can I think I can do both. So yeah, the Mars Edit link is certainly not going anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, we're going to, in the worst case scenario, we're going to motivate each other and inspire each other to make improvements to our apps because of something attractive that the other app has done. And that is what you call the, you know, positive competition. And I don't, you know, I don't, it's funny, Manton, you and I sort of had a very lightweight version of this, I think, kind of thinking when... I decided to do the Bit Splitting podcast.
Oh, right.
Because there was kind of a question in my mind, like, am I taking away attention space from Core Intuition? You know, it's like, it's true that all the podcasts in the world compete with each other for the attention and time of their listeners, right? But you just can't think about things that way. You just have to think, okay, we're all working on stuff. We all want to put good things out into the world. If you are making something good that other people like, that should never be, you can, like, you and I, as people who work on stuff, can be sort of like afraid of competition. Maybe the best example is being afraid of like competition from Apple, the so-called Sherlocking effect, right? Like, that's, you know, it's understandable and probably the most justified fear of competition is in that instance. But even in that case, if you think about it really abstractly, you know, if Apple does something better than what you're doing and it puts you out of business, like, the fact of the matter is there's something better in the world now, you know? Right. So it's like you have to, as a software developer who is interested in more than making money, you have to kind of have as a baseline foundation of your work an appreciation for good things existing in the world. And for that reason, I might be annoyed that I have to come up with a new way to make money if somebody comes out with something that puts all my stuff out of business. I'd be annoyed, and I might be scared, and I might be, I might find it tedious and frustrating to come up with a new plan for making a living. But it was never my goal in the first place to make money off of stuff that is not the best for what it does, you know?
Oh, that's a great way to look at it. And our first reaction when we see something that's competing or taking away from what we're doing, I think it naturally is to be afraid and to, you know, try to one up the other thing, or, you know, like have a reaction. But right, taking a step back and saying, well, there's a better tool there. I can acknowledge that. I can make my app better. I can just move things forward. That's why we got into software.
Yep.
To begin with. We started as users of computers and we saw an area that could be better.
Yeah.
Just to wrap up on the WordPress side, I mentioned I was at this little 2-day WordCamp conference. It turns out they have these like every weekend in some part of the world. And I think there are maybe 300 or 400 people there-ish, maybe something around there. And I will tell you, I learned a lot. I'm still kind of digesting, you know, what I learned from that conference. But I guarantee you what you said about 99% of WordPress users or don't use Mars Editor or any native app, I think that is accurate. Yep. I think I probably could have walked through that crowd and asked 100 people if they've heard of Mars Edit, and I'm sorry, they probably have not. And so it's a little depressing, but it's also an opportunity.
It is.
Yeah. All of those people, and I'm telling you, those people spend money. Like some of them don't, some of them want everything free, but some of those people have no problem dropping $50, $100 on a WordPress theme.
Yeah.
They have no problem if they have a website for their air conditioning company or whatever. You know, they have no problem paying money to make it better. And not everybody, but a lot of people. So I think that's a huge opportunity still for, yep. And a lot of these folks are paying WP Engine or, you know, one of these more expensive hosting companies, or even, you know, traditional ones, Dreamhost, whoever, whatever web host you have, Linode, they're paying them every month. And there's no reason why they can't be also paying for,
yep,
blogging software.
I totally agree, and it's one of the most frustrating things, and like you said, it's one of the most tantalizing things just to know, like there's all those people out there, they like blogging, and we just got to give them something on the Mac or on iOS that they simply can't get from the web interface. And that's sort of when I step back and think about the high level view of where Mars Edit's going, it's that kind of thinking that it's like, sometimes it can be frustrating. I feel like I'm just trying to keep up with the web interface, but then I have to step back and realize, no, I don't need to keep up with the web interface. I need to do things that they literally cannot do. And that's where the value, that's where people, like you said, are willing to spend money. So
that's right.
I have one quick question for you, Manton, before we sign off for the week. I think I know the answer, but you started a new Mac app in 2017. This is like from scratch? You made a new project in Xcode and everything?
Yes. I think I might have created the project like last year.
Okay.
But it like was not, you know, had like one file and it's been kind of just sitting there. But yeah, so almost all the code has been written in the last week. So yeah, and new, brand new Mac.
Brand new project. Mac app, all the code written in October 2017.
I think I know where this is going.
Therefore, it is all written in the industry standard Mac programming language. Swift.
It is all Objective-C. I have a little Swift code in the iOS app. some shared code. And, you know, it's difficult to find like open source shared code that's modern, that's written in Objective-C these days. So I have a little Swift code in the iOS app, but all the code I write is still in Objective-C. I'm not going to change that this year. I'll reevaluate it again next year.
Cool. All right. Just wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah. I'm not embarrassed. I'm not ashamed.
You can't hide your bracket pride.
Yeah. You know, I find Objective-C, I don't know if something, the new Xcode, I'm not going to say it's Objective-C hostile, but like it's kind of, I'm having trouble getting used to some of the changes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just like autocomplete and like clicking on things. And like, I need to go back in and like recustomize some stuff, but
yeah,
I'm not actually, since I've upgraded to Xcode 9, I cannot type Objective-C as fast as I used to. I don't know what exactly is happening, but
there definitely are some hostile design choices where I think they just are being there. They may be just a little oblivious to, in particular, mixed code environments. One that is catching me out a lot now is, if you have an Objective-C class and then you decide to be a, you know, well-behaved October 2017 Mac developer and add some unit tests for it in Swift. So you have like myclass.h, myclass.m, and status quo is you can do that little shortcut command option of arrow or whatever to flip between them, right? Open counterpart, I think, is the name.
Yeah.
And then bash, you add this myclass tests.swift, and they're trying to be clever and trying to be helpful that they include unit tests in as a counterpart. Sorry. So now you do that little loop and you cycle through .h.m.swift, and then you're stuck because once you're in Swift, it says, I don't know about anything but Swift, and it cycles you between the Swift file and like the exposed interface of the Swift file.
Okay. I feel like some of that counterpart stuff has changed too, because it's not as reliable. I'm not even talking about Swift here or unit tests, and I don't feel like it's as reliable. Like sometimes it just doesn't work. And like one of the things I do when I install a new version of Xcode is I customize the keyboard shortcut for that show counterpart or whatever it's called. Show header, show source, you know, flip. And I customize it because the default is like command something up arrow or something, which requires two hands. I customize it to control tab, works way better.
Huh.
Your left hand, as you're typing, you can very quickly show. So that's the only thing. I used to customize a lot more, like when I moved from whatever Code Warrior and Project Builder, and like I would customize some more things because I was used to old shortcuts. I'm used to all the new shortcuts, but that one. And I actually highly recommend changing that one to something like Control Tab or something you can do with your left hand. For some reason, Xcode 9, it keeps losing that. And it doesn't work as reliably. I don't know if it's a bug. I don't know if I just need to go in and customize the shortcut again or if there's other context that I'm missing. But I really like customizing that shortcut because I do it all the time.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've just stuck with the standards, but I can see the argument for switching that one.
All right, Daniel. Well, it's good talking today. We'll follow up on everyone's progress. I'm gonna be up in Chicago for release notes in a couple weeks, and I'm kind of eyeing that. You know, every time there's some event or something, I'm kind of eyeing that as maybe showing a beta or even releasing some of the Mac stuff that I've been working on. I hope it'll be far enough along by then. So yeah, we'll follow up in the next week or two about how everything's going.
Now, you're going to release notes. I'm envious of that, but you are also not speaking. Is that right?
I am not speaking.
So no, you're going to actually just enjoy it.
Yes. I have never spoken, but I've been the last 2 years. And yeah, it's nice to just soak it in, all the knowledge.
Nice. Well, that'll be fun. And good luck if that does help motivate you to make a new beta release of something. Darn it, now that you are on the racetrack with me, I better up my game here. Get this to the finish line before.
Ship it.
I will, with all my Swift on the server technologies, I will be impossible to catch.
No.
All right, folks, remember you can chat with us and all the other great members of our community at chat.coreint.org. We're also on Twitter @coreint. And if you need to get in touch with us privately, you can email us feedback@coreint.org. So thanks for listening, and Manton, I'll catch up with you next week.
See ya.